This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 234, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And my book, titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, has been published, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. This week, I'm talking to Richard Lang about his book, UAP Incidents, First Responders Guide, Police, EMS, FD. He is a certified MUFON field investigator. He is certified from the Virginia Department of Emergency Services as a search and rescue field team leader and is certified as a weapons of mass destruction responder. He managed part of the Advanced Aerospace Weapons Systems Applications Program at the Pentagon. Oh, hi, Richard. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, Simon.
So we're going to talk about one of your books. It's titled UAP Incidents, First Responder's Guide. But before we get into that, was there a UFO experience you had? You were a pilot and you heard other pilots reporting a UFO?
Yeah, a lot of people, I've been doing this for 30 years, and a lot of people ask me, like, what got you started, Richard? And I guess I'd have to be back in Florida in the late 70s. I was working on my degree in aeronautics, and I was also a flight student. I'd gotten a commercial instrument license. I'm flying up the coast one night of Florida by myself. I launched out of Daytona Beach, and I was heading towards Jacksonville, Florida. And the way that normally works in airplanes is usually, like, you have two communication radios. So one radio is tuned basically to where you were leaving the departure controller, if you will, and then the other radio is turned to the next destination, tuned into the next destination for the approach controller. So basically what happens is I'm listening to these radios, and that's what you normally do in flight. And I hear this Eastern airline captain call in to the air traffic controller saying that he's got, you know, traffic in his flight path. What that means is that there's another aircraft that's in his path that, you know, that where he's projected to go. Controller comes back and says negative radar contact, which means he's saying they can't see it on the radar. So a minute or two later, the pilot comes back and you could see he's getting a little more agitated. And he said, we have traffic in our flight path. And the controller comes back and says negative radar contact, you know, and you could sort of feel like things are getting a little tense. So finally, third time, the pilot calls in. He says, look, we've got traffic in our flight path. It's huge. It's unconventional. It's rotating over the ocean slowly, and it's got multicolored lights all over it. And the controller comes back, negative radar contact. Then another jet, a business jet, identifies, and he said, we have a visual on the saved object is Eastern. So now you've got two jets basically reporting this thing out over the ocean. I can't see it. It's too far out of the ocean for me to see it, but I go on up to land, because basically my plan was to go to Jacksonville, which at that time was a naval air station and civilian airport. I was going to land, get gas, and come back. When I called them to land, they wouldn't let me land. They told me to maintain holding for departing military traffic. And so I'm kind of flying around a circle. I look down and I see these two fighter jets come screaming off that runway, and they go out over the ocean. You can hear them booming through the sound barriers. You can see them all lit up with afterburners. And they went right out to where those pilots said that thing was. So essentially what happened is, you know, I landed, got my gas, and I went back to Daytona Beach. But the things I learned was basically there was for sure some unidentified, huge, unconventional aircraft out there that was reported by two pilots from different perspective angles and different aircraft. And the air traffic controllers refused to acknowledge that they had radar contact with it, but they obviously did something because they dispatched fighter jets to go out and check it out. So that was kind of my lesson that I learned. And that's sort of what got me going in all this a long time ago.
And you've become such an expert on it and had such great experience in parts of this.
Thank you.
You say that you've managed part of the Advanced Aerospace Weapons Systems Application Program at the Pentagon.
Yes. Let me tell you how that worked. Is essentially what happened is the Defense Intelligence Agency was interested in developing a program to study certain types of UFO activity. And they were working with Bigelow Aerospace, if you will. that was out in Las Vegas. And so a program was funded by the Defense Intelligence Agency to study that type of certain type of aircraft or UFO activity. And that basically Bigelow built a sister company. It was known as BASS. And that's where that money was, funding was directed into that program. I was hired to be, to work on part of that program. There was really, I've broken it down in my books. There were really two parts to it. There was a classified part and an unclassified part. And I ran the unclassified part, which was basically where we were looking at databases like MUFON, for example. And every month they would get 800 sighting reports. And so I had a time, we were all paid, of course, and I had a team of people that would go through those database sighting reports every day and vet them based on certain criteria that we used. And so you would get 800 reports a month and probably end up with about 50 really good cases that we want to look at. And a lot of had to do with vetting them was, you know, where they came from. For example, if you got a report that was filed by a pilot, a military pilot, someone in the military, an air traffic controller, police officers, all law enforcement people, those types of reports would go absolutely to the top of the priority list, if you can see what I'm saying. So essentially what we did is I'd get those 50 cases, and we had a team of people that were set up all over the United States, and essentially I would deploy an investigator to go out and interview the person to whatever the situation was, where it occurred. And then once that was done, they'd come back to me and give me a report. And then we'd you know, look at different things and modify the report to a certain format we were using. And then we'd submit it to BASS every Friday. And then they ultimately went to the Pentagon. At the time, we didn't understand completely what was going on the classified side with the Pentagon. But since then, there have been a number of books that have been written pretty much defining and explaining what we were doing.
Did MUFON know you were looking through all their reports?
Oh, yes, of course. We had a contract with them.
Ah.
No, the whole thing was essentially what happened is BASS had gotten together and negotiated a contract with MUFON. They were paying MUFON like $57,000 a month for that data that we were providing. And I ran the program as far as, you know, deploying the investigators and supervising all the people that were, you know, they going through the databases. But the whole thing was a contract, and everybody was paid, and MUFON got paid for all the data they got.
And what time period was that? Was it the 90s?
No. This was like around 2008.
And were there ever rumors around the classified stuff, or was it really strictly adhered to?
So essentially, I had my team. And then at BASS, it was Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies. The acronym was BASS. So there was a whole team of people on that side that they were operating out of a classified operation. So my job was to do, you know, deploy the investigators and vet the cases. But I had a dialogue. I talked to those guys every day. So people on the BASS side of the program, on a daily basis, we talked about cases and, you know, things that were submitted and that kind of thing. But the way it worked was the contract basically said that MUFON's providing the data. And so once we submitted cases to them, then they would deploy their people to maybe go and reinvestigate them or look into them in much more detail. In some cases have, you know, pretty specialized medical personnel that would go out and work with people and that kind of thing. But our agreement was that whatever they did was proprietary. You know, they're basically saying we're paying you for this data and this information, but whatever we do with it, we don't necessarily have to come back to you and tell you what we've done. Anything we develop is proprietary. And that was part of our agreement.
So there's always been this huge cover up of the UFO thing, like going back to the 1940s.
Yes.
Why cover it up? Couldn't they just say, yeah, this is amazing, we might have found life?
Well, Yeah, let me help you with that a little bit. And I've written about that extensively in my books, because the book that I have right now is basically to teach or help law enforcement people understand this phenomenon and know what to do and not do if they have the encounter. But I think a big part of that, understanding of that is the history lesson, if you will. And so essentially what I've done is prepared a chapter talking about how this all developed. And so it's a story that starts back in the Truman administration. And, you know, Truman, he was the vice president, and Roosevelt died. He became the president of the United States only, I think he was 80 some days into his term. So now Truman's president, and at the same time, they were recovering some of these craft. There were a number of them that had crashed and been recovered. Roswell was obviously one of them. And so Truman and his people are looking at these things. And I think what ended up happening is Truman was like, look, I don't know where they come from, who they are, but their technology is like hundreds of years ahead of us. And we need to study it so that we can use it for military applications. Remember, Truman was into technology because he used the atomic bomb. And nobody heard about the atomic bomb till we basically used it, started testing it, used it on Japan. So that was kind of how this all started. They created a group, a lot of people call it the Majestic 12 group. And essentially what he did is he commissioned some people from high-ranking government, bureaucratic people, some high-ranking military people. And my research, I was a little surprised to learn that half of those people were from the Commission on Foreign Relations, which still exists today. So they put a group of people together, and their job was just to recover the material, to make arrangements with private corporations, aerospace companies, electronics companies, research companies, to do back engineering and research, if you will. And it was done under a shroud of secrecy. The deals allowed them, these companies, to make money. You know, they could develop patent rights. They could make money on it, as long as they kept this technology and what they were doing secret, because at that time they were worried about our foreign adversaries getting hold of the information as well, but they kept it from the public. And so that's how this all evolved. And, you know, some of the examples that I used in my book was a guy named Philip Corso had written a book, and essentially his job was back in the end of the Truman administration, Eisenhower administration, his job was to take this crash wreckage and go out and make deals with these companies and then hand the wreckage over to them for research and back engineering. And he talked about some of the technology they developed. Well, if you look at one of the first things, Bell Laboratories, they gave there was some fiber optic tubing that had been recovered from a saucer type craft that was given to Bell Laboratories back around 1960. And of course, you know, now half the world is wired together with fiber optic tubing, if you're with me. And they did the same thing with electronic technologies. All the microchip circuitry came from these crafts that was given to IBM and Texas Instruments. And so these corporations basically had this really advanced technology, and they start doing the research. And the next thing you know, they're making billions of dollars on this stuff. So by the time Eisenhower's towards the end of his term, he's president, and he was becoming more and more frustrated with them, because they basically, the government was giving them this technology, the wreckage, if you will. And at the same time, these companies are starting to cut the government out of the loop. And they basically went renegade on Eisenhower and the Congress, and they weren't telling them what they were doing anymore. These companies just went off to be autonomous and started doing their own thing. And that's why when Eisenhower left office, you know, he said, beware of the military industrial complex because of the misplaced power. And that's what he was talking about, is that they would no longer share that kind of information with the president and Congress. And it made them very powerful. And so now what you see, you know, you fast forward to, you know, another 60, 70 years, and now you've got all these super powerful aerospace companies and defense contractors that are still in possession of all this material and using it for their benefit and making billions of dollars on it. And they're not really in any hurry to have the public get involved in all this and understand, you know, essentially what they've been doing. And so that's kind of how the whole thing, the secrecy, if you will, it's all about money and you know, the advances made in real estate in research and how these companies have gotten so wealthy. And that's what it's all about now. I think a lot of it has to do with just the financial aspects of keeping it secret, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and I suppose Congress can't really order these companies around. They don't have the authority.
Well, that's part of the thing that one of the things that people ask me all the time, like, well, why does the government just tell us what they have? Well, the problem is the government doesn't have it anymore. And that's exactly what they did, is they would take this wreckage, this material, and hand it over to a private company. And the private company then owns it. And they're going to say, wait a minute, this is proprietary material. You know, they're not subject to any kind of Freedom of Information Act requests or any kind of congressional oversight. And they pretty much can do what they want. And that's how they've maintained the secrecy this long, because basically the government doesn't own the material, doesn't have it anymore. And so they can sort of be autonomous and just say, hey, you know, they're not lying when they say they don't know what's going on with it in a lot of cases. And so that's where the whole thing is starting to unfold now. And if you look at American politics right now, there's so much energy that's going on in Congress right now.
And so do you think the people who have this knowledge, like the secret keepers, you might call them, all these big companies, they're getting a bit scared now?
Well, I think what happened was back in like 2022, there was a lot of energy in Congress where they're getting all these reports of this autonomous behavior, you know, these craft are invading restricted airspace, they're around nuclear missile silos facilities, some cases where they've actually neutralized some of those things. And so what happened was they basically were interviewing people from the Pentagon, and honestly, the Pentagon people were lying to them, and they knew they were being lied to. So the group, the Defense Intelligence Group in Congress at that time, I think it was headed up by Rubio, basically they put every year, there's a bill that goes through the Congress. It's called the National Defense Authorization Act. And that basically authorizes all the money for the different parts of the military. And so what they did is they put language in that bill that basically said anyone, you know, that had direct hands-on exposure to these non-human craft that's been recovered, or the bodies, the biologicals, said if, you know, and it's specifically said in the agreement that if you've actually had hands-on experience with this, you would have signed a national security agreement. And if you come forward and testify in a congressional hearing, you're protected by federal law. You can't be arrested or prosecuted for telling Congress what's going on. And it said even if you sign a national security agreement, you're granted amnesty and immunity if you testify in congressional hearings. And so that in 2023, that bill went through. It went through the House, the Senate approved it, and the president signed it. So now it's federal law, and all these people are protected. And that's why you're seeing all this stuff all of a sudden bubbling out, you know, is because all these people have come forward and testified in these congressional hearings about what's going on. You know, one of the first ones was a guy named David Gresh, and it was a nationally televised hearing. And he was talking, you know, basically he said, look, this is the most highly classified secret in the United States government. It's a covert operation to keep all this work completely out of the hands of the administration, you know, the executive branch and the congressional. And they've been doing it for 50 or 60 years. And they're doing back engineering and research in facilities all over the country. And some of those congressmen are like, well, where are they? And he's like, if you come in the skiff, I'll give you a list of them, what's in them. So that's what started it. So now you see you've got a number of people in Congress. I'd guess more than 50 or 60 of them that are very interested in what's going on with this. And then there's been a lot of pressure put on the executive branch, so the president, to, you know, basically release the the files and declassify them. And that's why you're just now you're starting to see that happen. It's like I've been doing this for 30 years and there's more stuff that's come out in the last year or so than there has in the last 30 years.
There must be hundreds or thousands of people with all sorts of knowledge on this stuff. Why do you think there aren't more whistleblowers?
Well, because up until this time that these laws were changed, if you went in and you worked on a project, you signed a national security agreement, you could go to prison. Your pensions could be confiscated. Your life would be ruined. In some cases, you could even be executed if it was high enough. So these people are they're afraid. You know, they're not going to go to jail or lose everything they have over it. So the agreements were very strict and stringent up until, you know, a couple, 3 years ago. They were they've been sort of released from some of their security arrangements, and still a lot of this information is still classified, and you can't talk about that.
Well, I wanted to ask you about an incident that happened with Eisenhower. Was there a time he kind of put out an ultimatum about Area 51 and basically said, I'm coming to look at it?
Yes. One of the most interesting interviews I've ever seen was done by Richard Dolan. And he interviewed an individual. It was a couple years ago, maybe. And the guy was very old and he was not well, physically well. And he was like in a nursing home. And he's like, I want to get this off my chest because I'm not going to be here much longer, you know. And basically he tells us this story. He tell Richard this story where, you know, he worked in Project Blue Book. And back then he said he had a Q clearance, which is the highest clearance you can get that would give you access to this kind of information. And he would, you know, he said, we'd go out and interview people. And he was kind of smiling when he said it, but he said, we'd go out and interview somebody and tell them, oh, all they just saw was swamp gas, you know, and he'd laugh when he said it. And just try to cover it up as much as possible and keep it out of the public, you know, domain. And he says one day he gets his boss contacts them and they're ordered to come to the White House. And so basically they go to the White House and they're in the Oval Office and Eisenhower's talking to them and he's really mad. And he told them that, you know, he'd been making inquiries. And this is based on this guy's testimony in this videotape, but I'm pretty sure there's been a lot of stuff that I've seen that corroborates it. I'm pretty sure it's true. But basically, Eisenhower tells him, look, you know, I've been asking them what's going on at Area 51, and they keep coming back and telling Eisenhower that he doesn't have a high enough security clearance, which you can understand how he might get a little upset about that. So what he did was he told them to take his airplane. At that time, it was a Lockheed Electra. I guess that would have been the first Air Force One, if you will. And he sent them out to Area 51 in this plane. He said, here's the message I want you to give them. And essentially the message was, you know, I want this information that I want to be, I want it on my desk by a week from Friday at noon. And if I don't get it, I'm going to come out and take command of the 1st Cavalry in Colorado, and I'm going to come in there and invade that place. And so the guys, you know, they allegedly went out there and had the meetings with these guys. And of course, they came back and briefed Eisenhower, talked about alien bodies that were there and all kinds of craft that was been recovered and all kinds of research that was going on. And he said that Eisenhower was really upset because they had basically taken the government out of the loop. And these guys were operating on, you know, they're basically now autonomous private companies, and they were pretty much doing whatever they were doing without involving the government. And he was really upset about that. And of course, that's why when he was ready in his farewell speech, he said, beware the military industrial complex because of the misplaced power. And that's what he was talking about. We believe, I'm sure.
And I suppose as Eisenhower was in charge in the Second World War, they're going to listen to him when he says he's going to come down there with the cavalry.
Exactly. I mean, this is the general that won World War II, and they're like, he probably knows how to do this. And he is. See, the problem you have is that it's not a problem, but the president of the United States is commander in chief of the military. And that means he can go on any military base anywhere in the world anytime he wants. But what I found out in my research is Area 51 is not a military base. It's a CIA base. which was really surprising. But that's what the rub was. And so, you know, with obviously with his reputation, and I'm sure they told him he was really mad and upset about it, that he was going to come out and take the military and come in there and invade the place. And I'm quite sure he probably would have if they wouldn't have given him the information he wanted to have.
So with these crashes, these craft that were retrieved, do you feel the crashes were an accident or perhaps they were crashed on purpose, some way of giving?
Well, yes. Let me answer. That's a really good question. And in the answer to that varies based on different times. So what we know is that in the early, you know, back in the Truman days, if you will, in the World War II era, the military, the United States had built these really powerful anti-aircraft radar stations to avoid another Pearl Harbor type event. So that these aircraft, these anti-aircraft radar are very powerful and they reach out long distances to detect, you know, aircraft or air traffic, if you will. And what we know is that those saucer type craft, it's a type of propulsion. They call it electrogravitic propulsion. When they fly through one of those radar beams like that, it disables their propulsion and causes them to crash. So we believe that back in that era, a lot of the crashes that were recovered were a result of them basically flying into that radar and getting disabled and crashing. So that's how the original, I think a lot of those crashes originally were dealt like that, had like that. Now, if you fast forward to today, there's a lot of information out there they call them psionic assets. And these are people that basically can telepathically communicate with those craft or the consciousness within the craft and draw them in. You notice that it's real famous, Stephen Greer's group, CE5 group, where they go out and get a bunch of people and they meditate in a field and they can actually call them in. And that's pretty well documented. I've personally known people that have been out and worked on those things and done that. And it really does happen. But the problem is that there are some of these paramilitary groups some of these defense contractors, if you will, they've cultivated people that have the psychic ability to do just that, where they can telepathically communicate with something and draw it in. And then it's heartbreaking to think about this, but they use those people to draw them in. And now they're using energy weapons to try to knock some of them down and shoot them down. And I believe that's starting to happen now. It's very sad and heartbreaking to think they'd be doing that. But I think that the fact is there is some of that going on. And there's also what they call, researchers call it gifts. And a gift is, there's been a number of cases where a craft has been landed somewhere and basically they leave the door open and leave. And just leave it in there. Leave it there. It's like putting a car in the mall with the keys in it. And they call them gifts, but there's been some of those types of craft that have actually been just landed and, you know, made available to different cultures around the world. I have no idea why they do that, but it has been done. If that makes sense.
And also, it's weird if they were genuine accidents, the aliens don't seem to have their own crash retrieval team or ambulance that wants to help out their colleagues.
Well, no. You know, and in my book, I've talked about recovery teams, and there are cases where, like, something's crashed, and we can talk about that a little bit, but essentially there are reconnaissance units that are on standby alert, that if something crashes, they go after it. Now, not only are they chasing flying saucers and UAPs, but there's also, you know, if a military aircraft comes down with a nuclear weapon on or something like that, all that kind of piece of a satellite crashes, these teams are ready to go and they go out and they recover that stuff. But there are cases where recon units are like on the way and something crashes, and then another non-human craft comes up and rescues the people at the crash wreckage. That's happened too.
The crash retrieval teams, the humans, you think yes. They're all over the world. Like the Russians have them, the Chinese have them, the Japanese. Yes,
but there's, I would say that there's what was known as the Legacy Program. It's only recently, maybe in a year or so, come out public domain. And basically what they talked about is how this whole crash recovery system works, if you will. And it kind of goes like this: is there's an office of the CIA that has made agreements with a whole bunch of countries, and if something crashes, they have control of it. They have the technology through NORAD and some of these other things that, you know, if a crash materializes in our airspace and crashes, they know about it, and they're going to be in charge of coordinating the recovery. Then, you know, the Air Force and the Department of Energy have these teams. They go by the acronym is NEST, and those teams are commissioned through the Department of Energy. And you've got people that are, you know, paramilitary types like Navy SEALs and guys like that that work on those teams. They're armed to the teeth, and they have all the equipment, including they've got helicopters and private jets, and they can go pretty much anywhere very quickly. And they are primarily responsible, I would say, with recovering a lot of this stuff, if you will. And then once they recover it, it's the same gig as it goes, and they work through a program to divvy that material out to different companies for research and, you know, for back engineering and research, that kind of thing.
I suppose, you know, the Russians, the Chinese are not going to hand over whatever they have to the CIA. So they must have their own teams.
Well, the thing, I think that a lot of people say that, and I think that if you think about it, in the United States right now, this secrecy that's been basically controlled all these years is not so much about the government, but it's about these private multinational corporations that have mostly defense contractors that have a really strong handle on all this. Well, the key is they're multinational corporations. So these companies have the same power in Russia and China as they do here. So, you know, there might be somebody in the Chinese government say, hey, let's talk about this. And they're like, you know, suddenly it doesn't happen. But I think that these private corporations, these aerospace companies, have a really strong, powerful handle on all this stuff. And, you know, that would prevail as in Russia, China, or anywhere else. That I think that's a lot of that has a lot to do with that.
Do you think that we have alien reproduction vehicles that they can maneuver just as well as the originals?
Yes. Again, you're talking to somebody that's been doing this research for 30 years, and I've literally looked at thousands of these case reports. I've worked on hundreds of them, and you know, in those programs, I supervised hundreds of investigations, if you will. They're with people that are in my realm, if you will, my contemporaries. We will tell you that if you look at these databases, there's a certain type of craft, for example, that we believe is a man-made. They call them alien reproduction vehicles. And basically, it's a triangle-type craft, you know, and it's got a little white light in each corner and a red light in the middle. And these are pretty well identified as craft that are man-made. And, you know, Raytheon and Lockheed Martin have been making them for 15 years. And so, yeah, they do.
So if there's this attack on Iran, they don't want to use these alien reproduction vehicles. If there is a war with Iran, that they hold them back, in case there's a nuclear war or something?
Well, I really couldn't count. I can't really answer that question because I don't know what kind of secret technology the military is using. So far, I've not seen any reports or anything where they're saying that these triangle crafts went in and blew up buildings and cities and stuff like that. I don't think that's happening. But again, I'm not I'm not privy to any of that military information that they might be using. I kind of doubt they'd do that, but.
I suppose you only use what you have to use. You don't use stuff that you don't really need to, because then your potential enemies can learn what you've got.
Well, that's part of it, I think. And, you know, the technology that's involved in this stuff is it's extremely secret and well kept. There was a crash in Mexico, and I don't have I don't have all the details in front of me, but one of the guys that I worked with on my team had written a book about it, and I talked to him about it a few months ago. And basically, what happened, there was a crash that occurred where a saucer collided with a private airplane. And, you know, these reconnaissance teams, the Mexican government sent some guys down there to recover it. In the meantime, the next thing you know, the American reconnaissance guys show up and all the Mexican guys end up dead. And then they took the craft away. So, you know, it's just the whole thing was very mysterious. And then, and again, I've been told about, and I can't prove it one way or another, but there's pretty strong evidence indicating that out in Nevada somewhere, that one of these triangle craft like we're talking about, it crashed. And it was owned by Lockheed Martin. So they sent their guys out there to recover it. And then in the meantime, the government reconnaissance guys show up, and there's apparently a shootout, and some guys got killed. And part of that was because Lockheed Martin doesn't want these other companies to have access to their technology, that kind of thing, where they're hiding it from, you know, each other. But that kind of stuff does happen. And the a lot of what, when I wrote the book, one of the things that we were concerned, the triangle craft, some people refer to it. I just looked in the book here. It's in the book. It says TR-3B. That's the classification for these triangle craft that are supposedly made by the military. That's unofficial, but that there's a lot of people that have information. They call it TR-3Bs, and they're basically triangles.
So in the book, you've got a section that's the problems associated with disclosure. So what are the problems?
I had written a chapter about that, and there was five or six things that that I think are worth talking about. The idea, again, with all that's going on, a lot of this is heavily involved in financial things. There's a guy named Chris Mellon that was very high up in the intelligence world, and you know, he's been one of the whistleblowers that's involved in a lot of this stuff. But he wrote, and I quoted him in my book, and he basically said that this whole concept of disclosure, I think the game plan is they'd like to drag this out for like 10 or 12 years. And you know, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with those guys being able to cash in their stock and their patent rights and get out of town before the public finds out what they've been doing for the last 50 years. But and they're going to feed it to you a little bit at a time. That's the plan. But he said, if we have a catastrophic disclosure, which would mean that something would happen and the whole thing hits the fan, and it all of a sudden, all this stuff becomes blatant public information, he said it's going to cause a dramatic financial global meltdown. The markets will collapse. And people say, well, why would that be? The reason for it is because of the advanced technology that's involved with all this stuff. You know, one of these guys I met with a long time ago, they produced a movie called The Lost Century, and it was talking about the technology, basically zero-point energy, which is devices that will produce free energy. And this guy came to me one day, and we were having lunch, and he said, if I came in here and I put a briefcase or a small suitcase down on this table, and I told you that inside this case is a device that'll generate enough electric power to power every house within a 500-mile radius of this building, and it'll run for 1,000 years without any renewable energy, and it won't put out any pollution, what do you think that'll do to the economy? And back then, I was in the financial world, and I'm thinking that'd put the, you know, the energy sector out of business, because all this coal and oil and all these commodities would be pretty much worthless as soon as that technology becomes available to the public. And he goes, that's right, and that's why they're not going to let you have it. So you've got that kind of, you know, free energy production, technology. You've got, clearly there's technology for, you know, anti-gravity transportation. We know for a fact that these triangle vehicles that have been developed, they're not aerodynamic. They use an electrogravitic type of propulsion. When that's available, and also medical technology that would be available, it's going to initially cause a lot of mayhem in the financial worlds. Ultimately, the benefit to humanity will be unbelievable. But in the short term, it's going to be tough economically. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's, I think, if the people that, you know, in Washington right now, there's a lot of there. One of them is the New Paradigm Institute. And that's a group of lawyers that are really pushing to get this transparency and disclosure. And what I'm hearing from guys up in Washington is the biggest thing that they're worried about is if it all comes out, what the financial impact would be of it.
And what do you make of these reports of missing or dead people that are involved with this?
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot about that. I personally don't know any of those individuals or haven't worked with any of those individuals, but there is apparently a group of people that were, I think when there was an interview with Obama a month or two ago, and they asked him about UAPs, and he goes, yeah, they're real. And then after that, Trump said, you know, he was going to declassify this stuff. So it's kind of like a snowball, if you will, that's coming, where they're going to have to declassify that. And at the same time, these people that would be in key positions where they're clearly powerful insiders that are suddenly, some of them are dying, disappearing. It's just very strange. And there's a number of people that's starting to happen to. And so you got to wonder if there might be something to that. But these people, like, people ask me, well, aren't you worried? And I'm like, no, because I'm not an insider. And the difference is yes, I interview people and write reports, but I've never been in a job where I'm putting alien bodies in glass tubes. You know what I'm saying? Where some of these people are working on inside in these projects where they've got hands-on control of this wreckage. They're handling alien, you know, non-human biologicals, and they've got firsthand information, insider information about it. Those are the people I think you really need to worry about.
And do you think the rumors have been around for years of a false flag kind of alien invasion that's ever been considered?
Well, I wrote that in my book. That's one of the things that we talked, you know, what you asked me about, the deterrence to it. And there's a fair amount of people in this UAP, you know, the UAP research people and government people, and what they're talking about is a false flag. And so what that would amount to is, you know, a false flag, you kind of define it as where a company will do something, blow something up, or do something destructive, and then they'll blame it on their enemies to get sympathy for their causes. So what the thinking is that you might have a situation where, say, these defense contractors would do something, like maybe do some kind of a holographic display that make it look like a whole bunch of these UFOs are going to come in and, you know, attack us or something, and create fear. And by doing that, then they go to Congress, and then they can get all this money allocated to them to defend us from those potential adversaries that they've kind of created. So yeah, that's something that's it's thought about. And if you look at, you know, a lot of this recent disclosure that's coming out, there's a movie that was produced back in November. It was called The Age of Disclosure. And If you watch that movie, you've got about 30, I recommended it. There's about 35 admirals, generals, high ranking government officials. I think there's two former heads of the CIA, the current Secretary of State, and they're all saying the same thing. Look, we're not alone. These UAPs are real. They're here. They've been here, and we've been involved with them in some respect. That's the basic, the general message that's coming out of these from these government people. And they're also saying it's a threat to national security. And they're basing that on the fact that, you know, these aircraft, they go into restricted airspace. There's been cases where they've flown over nuclear missile silo facilities and shut the whole place down. So because they've interfered with our these kinds of things, almost always related to something about nuclear energy or nuclear weapons, they're saying that they're a threat to national security. And I'm not sure, you know, where that's all going. I did, in my book, I said, if you want to do a false flag and say that these aliens are going to attack us, the first step to doing that is you have to admit they're real. Before you can have a false flag, you've got to come out and publicly say, yeah, this stuff's all real. And so, you know, is all this disclosure the precursor for something like that? I don't know, but it's an interesting thought.
And do you think Hollywood's ever been, like, briefed on anything? I mean, Spielberg's got his disclosure film coming out soon, hasn't he?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at some of his films, you know, that one that was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And as a researcher, I saw that film when it came out in 1980, and I can't tell you how many of the elements of that film were real. You know, like Jacques Vallée and some of those guys they were like the technical advisors on that film. These are like UFO research people. And so, yeah, I remember when E.T. came out, Spielberg did that one. And President Reagan had what do they call it when you have a movie premiere at the White House? And so they had a big party and they had the premiere of the movie and Spielberg's there and Reagan's there. And Reagan was quoted as saying, some people close around him, he said, you know, there's only six people in this room that know how true this really is. He was talking about the movie E.T. And, you know, since then, Spielberg produced, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And now he's produced the movie that's Disclosure Day that's going to come out in a few weeks. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see where that all goes. And I saw an interview that he did in it. You know, I mean, he said something to the effect, years ago, we always wanted to believe this is true. And then at the end, he said, now we know it's true. I thought, okay. it'll be interesting to see how that movie plays all this.
And also in the trailer, I've seen elements in there that look like they're part of the abduction phenomenon, and like Scream images where there's a huge deer there and other animals in the bedroom.
Yeah, I don't know where that's going. And I was talking to one of my coworkers, and we were going to do a thing about abduction, and we were all agreeing we need to watch, see where this movie goes before we take the next step, because I just don't know. But I think it's going to be really interesting.
Have you had much of an interest in the alien abduction phenomenon over the years?
Well, and I've sort of said this in my background again, I've been doing this for 30 years. And there was a time when I just ended up working on one case after another that was abductees. I probably interviewed maybe 50 people that have had firsthand direct contact with ETs or been abducted. And it's hard research because I can tell you this, that when I started doing that, you know, I mean, I'm a guy, I've got a degree in aeronautics. And I'm a commercial pilot and all that. And that's all very scientific stuff, if you will. And so I'm in there interviewing this woman, and she's actually a pretty famous abductee. There's some books written about her. And she's starting to tell me what happened. And I vividly remember thinking, Richard, you need to get out of here. This lady's crazy. You really need to get out of here. And I'm sitting in her living room thinking, I got to get out of here. And so then I went and interviewed another one, and it was the same thing. Some of the stuff is so creepy. It was just creeping me out. I'm like, man, you know, I got to get out of here. you know, and then I'd do another one and another one and another one. Well, after I did about 10 of those, got to know 10 of those people, I vividly remember driving home one night in the middle. It was late at night in Virginia. And I'm thinking, you know, these people, they're all telling you the same story. You know, they're all the little subtle elements are all the same. And it's like, you know, they're telling the truth. And if they're telling the truth, that means half the stuff I learned in college in physics isn't what we think it is. And so that's kind of what I've defined as like your change of your perception of reality, if you will. And if you really want to get into being a really good investigator with this, you got to get through that. And sometimes it's not so easy to do.
And also interviewing these people who've had these experiences, which I've interviewed 50 or 60 of them for the podcast, you start to realize that it's not just biological beings like us in metal spacecraft. There seems to be something more to do with consciousness and interdimensional.
Yes. And you know, a lot of time, and that's probably a good thing to talk about too, is a lot of people will ask me, like, where do they come from? And it used to be we called them ETs, extraterrestrials, or we called them EBEs, extraterrestrial biological entities, okay? And when you say that, that connotates that they come from other planets in outer space. Well, some of them do come from other planets in outer space, but some of them come from other dimensions. Some of them come from other time constraints, mostly from the future coming back. And some of them are interterrestrial. So now we use the term NHI, non-human intelligence, because it's a more accurate way of defining them because of their origin. And even now, you know, when you say interterrestrial, kind of makes you spin a little bit. But one of the congressmen that's been very vocal about some of this stuff that they're learning now said that, I don't know, maybe two or three, maybe a month ago, they had an interview with two admirals from the United States Navy. And these guys told them that there were two places that the Navy's discovered deep underneath the ocean. These places are like the size of huge cities, and they're all occupied by non-humans. Now, you wouldn't have heard that 3 or 4 years ago. But that's, when you hear that, that like makes your head spin a little bit. But it makes sense because, you know, the thing with UFOs or UAPs, everybody's walking around with a high-definition video camera in their pocket, their cell phone. But if you're tracking something under the ocean, the only people that would ever have access to that information are like on the command deck of a nuclear submarine or the bridge of a ship, and where you've got people that are tracking vehicles on sonar. You know, the thing is with water, when something goes through the water slows it down. Like if you were to fire a bullet into a big pond, you know, that bullet might go a mile through the air and it'll go about 10 or 12 feet through the water because of the resistance of the water. And so if you look at the most powerful submarines only go about 50 miles an hour, it's called hull speed. And that's just basically the constraint of having to break through the water. Well, you're getting reports of these, you know, one of the reports was something the size of a football stadium's going 700 miles an hour under the water. That's pretty advanced technology, you know. It's not possible by any of our foreign adversaries. But that's the kind of stuff that's starting to come out to the public just recently.
Can you tell us about your other books and can you tell us where people can find them?
Yes, thank you. Right now, I've got this book was a rewrite. The book that the UAP Incidents First Responders Guide is actually a revision of the original book that was the same subject. But we revised it because there's just been so much has happened in the last couple of years that I wanted to update it and make sure it was accurate, which it is. First book I wrote was called, it was a guide to basically investigate the phenomena, the methodology for, it was called the methodology for New Age. And a lot of it had to do with like the multidimensional aspects and different levels of human consciousness and things like that. And then I also wrote a book called The Age of Disclosure, What the Government Knows About UFOs. That's kind of the middle book. We're about to revise that one too, just to put make sure everything is updated in it. And then you can find our, if you, the best thing to do is go to the website. It's called Aerospace Research Operations. The acronym is AeroOps. It's, if you just go to AEROPS.site, that site, it'll pull up, and there's, you know, copies of all the books you, where you can order them and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of other things that we've done in terms of, like, you know, interviews about abduction and different things that, that we've worked on. But the AEROPS.site is it's a pretty handy, you know, everything that, that we've talked about and everything that, that's I'm involved in is on that site somewhere. I'm working on a book right now. All my books have been very technical and, you know, like targeted at certain groups, if you will. I'm working on a book right now. It's called Case Files. And it's, and basically it's a series of books that I'm going to work on where each chapter is a story about something that happened to someone. And it's written from their personal perspective. And the whole idea with the book is to convey the paranormal, you know, phenomena and really help someone experience it and kind of feel it firsthand. But and it's a variety of all different, it's all stuff that I've worked on over the last 30 years, and it's a variety of all different kinds of cases. And that one will be out later on this summer.
Maybe you can come back to the podcast when it's published.
I was going to say, when I get that one ready, I'll text you and we can try it again.
Well, thanks a lot for doing this, and thanks for giving us your time.
No, no problem. I enjoyed it. I appreciate the opportunity.
And that was an interview with Richard Lang about his book, UAP Incidents First Responders Guide, Police, EMS, FD. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/AlienUFOPodcast. And my website is simonbound.com. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.